So with that, we're ready to proceed to the third matter on our calendar today. Again, we're reconstituting the panel, so that will take just a few moments. If the attorneys are here for the third matter, I'd ask you to settle yourselves in at council table. And I'll ask the marshal to call the third matter.
Case A19-1466, John Noel McCormick, petitioner appellant versus commissioner of public safety, respondent.
All right, and counsel, I'm sure you're familiar with our procedures, but I'll make just a few remarks, which is please do take your time to pour yourselves a glass of water, settle your materials, catch your breath, that sort of thing. And then when you do approach the lectern, take whatever time you need to make some adjustments. The height of the microphone can go up and down, and it will make the recording better if you just take that time, as well as the height of the lectern can be adjusted with a button on the bottom, and then perhaps you have materials you want to have nearby and available to you. When you are ready, just go ahead and proceed. I'll ask that you start your remarks so that we have a clear record with your name as well as the name of the client that you represent. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Robert M. Christensen, and I represent John McCormick in this implied consent appeal. Counsel, thank you for the opportunity to be here to address you with our arguments here. So the first four things I want to tell you are the themes of my argument here today. Number one, I was actually here yesterday on another oral argument unrelated to this issue, but I was going through the cafeteria, and there's a poster in the cafeteria that says, where the rule of law ends, tyranny begins. And I'm going to come back to that theme. The other theme I have is if the government lives by the sword, they got to die by the sword. The third thing I want to say is that we need this court to promote respect for the law. And that doesn't just apply to the citizens that are arrested or their licenses are revoked. It also applies to those that are enforcing the law. That when there's a law change, we have to have respect for the law. And then the last thing is, as I've read in several of the unpublished decisions that the counsel for the commissioner cites and that this court says over and over again, is that it's highly recommended that you follow the implied consent law. We really, really want you to do it. But then we give excuses when they don't. So that's, you know, it's highly recommended they should follow it, but then when they don't, there's no consequence. So, you know, where's the respect there? And so what this issue comes down to is the fact situation, and that is the background is that prior to 2016 in the state of Minnesota and elsewhere in the country where they had refusal laws, it was a crime to refuse a blood, breath, or urine test. And it was being challenged here and in North Dakota over and over again. And finally,
right, counsel, we're familiar, right. Very intimately familiar with the whole history of the
3B. I'm aware of that, yes. And so what I want to say is that the United States Supreme Court, after much toil and tribulation, money spent, litigation through two state Supreme Courts, all the way to the United States Supreme Court, they take, what, 80 cases out of 10,000 requests a year? They took this one. And they came down with a earth-changing decision in how we apply these laws. And they said, you know what? You can't be charged with a refusal to take a test of a warrantless blood or urine test, but not so for a breath test. So the Minnesota legislature in 2017 amends the statute that we're talking about that I know you're very familiar with. And they inserted the word breath to modify test to reflect that huge, important part of the law. And so when Mr. McCormick was read the implied consent advisory, he was not informed of the correct law.
The officer told him that it was going to be a breath test, that this is the breath test advisory of appellant, right?
That is the title of the form.
No, that's what I understand. It's the title of the form, but that's what the officer had told the appellant at the very beginning.
He read that this is the title of the form. This is the breath test advisory, is what he said.
Right. And then the officer asked appellant after reading the advisory if appellant would take a breath test.
Correct.
Did the officer mention any other tests?
No.
Blood test?
No.
Urine test?
No.
Only test that was referred to twice was a breath test.
I believe that's true.
Okay, so why isn't that sufficient?
Well, citizens are presumed to know the law. So we have to presume that Mr. McCormick knows that there's two other types of tests that are legally allowed to be requested of a person who officer has probable cause for the arrest. So
right, but there's only one test that's being requested of the appellant.
But there's two other possible tests he could have been offered.
But he wasn't offered those.
He could have been.
But he wasn't.
Doesn't matter.
So, counsel, here's what I'm struggling with, if I can just follow up quickly, is, and I understand your different take on the facts, but what's the misstatement that you're saying that our officer
Because
made?
Refusal to take a test is a crime is not an accurate rendition of the law change. It doesn't give respect to the law.
Well, the district court looked at it this way. I mean, the district court read the officer's comments in context.
So we're going to
And are you suggesting we should view those comments differently?
Yeah.
And, okay,
This is the sword rule. This is, you know, you write a statute that says it's over 0.12 to be a 0.12 blood alcohol content in the 70s. Then they bring it down to 1.0. Now they bring it down to 0.08. I mean, are we going to afford the same excuse to a citizen? It's like, well, I was a 0.08001. Well, is that really that much different than an 07999?
So
we draw a line in the sand. We drive a sword. And then we also say that you got to accurately inform the citizens of the law. And we have to presume, you know, that you know the law. You know, you get pulled over and you're like, I didn't know it was illegal. Well, sorry, sir.
These are the laws
in the state of Minnesota. You got
to
follow
them. I'm going to ask you to stop speaking when one of the judges attempts to ask a question.
My apologies.
So I believe Judge Reyes has tried a couple of times.
Yes, I believe
so. And I understand you're passionate about your case, and we're definitely ready to listen to you. Follow those courtesies. Thanks.
Yes.
So, counsel, under Minnesota Statute 169A.51, subdivision 2, is there anything under that statute that requires the statement to be read by officers verbatim?
It says that they're supposed to read that to them. It has to be accurate. Yeah. I would read that, yes, they want to be informed of that. They changed the statute to put the word breath in.
Right.
That was the only change they made. So I would think that the legislature would expect that the cops need to say that word.
But is there anything in the statute that says the officers have to read the statute verbatim, word for word? Okay. Is there any case law that requires officers to read the statement verbatim, that requires the officers to do so?
I don't know if it's stated in those terms other than what this court has said before, that it's highly recommended and they should do it.
Recommended but not required.
I think this is a mandatory provision. It says shall be informed of the rights under 169A.51 subdivision 2. The word shall means mandatory. You shall do this.
Well, and you raise a good point there, counsel. So the word shall is mandatory. But the word inform, the district court interpreted the word inform. Do you disagree with the district court's interpretation?
Absolutely. She uses the word some metaphysical possibility that it could be anything other than a breath test. But, you know, you're talking to people who are under the influence of alcohol, and now you're expecting them to read into context, you know, and to listen under those very stressful situation. Many of them have never been through this before, and now they're supposed to be able to have some sort of reading, listening comprehension skills to listen in context to things, you know? It's, you know, why are we making excuses for the police here when they don't follow the law?
Well,
when we talk about respect for the law and where the rule of law ends, tyranny begins, this is what we're talking about. And there's social policy reasons here that there's a lot of unrest between law enforcement and the citizens, and this is why. The citizen has to comply with the law. They can't be 0.08 or more.
So I want to go back to inform. So the district court relied on interpreting that word on the American Heritage Dictionary, in other words, to see how is it commonly used, and said that it means, it's a transitive verb, which means to impart information to, make aware of something. imparting information is to someone is distinct from reading language verbatim. So why isn't, when you look at the context, and you mentioned the unpublished cases, other cases that where we said, you know, as long as you inform them of what is going to happen, I want to go back, do you disagree with the district court's interpretation of the word informed by relying on the dictionary definition, which is a common way of ascertaining the plain meaning of the word?
Well, yes, of course. That's why we're here. I look at the word breath. That's an adjective noun. And I cited my old high school grammar book that I still keep and refer to in my writings. And, you know, you put the adjective noun in front of the noun that it's going to modify.
Well, I don't think that's in dispute at all. I'm trying to clarify as to whether or not you disagree with the district court relying on a common dictionary that is used extensively, or do you think there should be another definition of inform?
No, I just think that this Mr. McCormick was misinformed. It's a misstatement of the law. You look at that independent statement, an independent clause. It says refusal to take a test is a crime. That is a false statement. The statement is, and what the legislature wanted and the United States Supreme Court dictated, was that only breath tests.
So, Mr. Christensen, if I can jump in, I understand the argument that you're making, because mm-hmm. I think if the officer, or if let's say the form, because I think the officer was reading the form.
Yeah.
If the form itself at question number two or point number two said refusal to take a urine test is a crime, it didn't say breath, it didn't leave it blank, but it actually said refusal to take a urine test is a crime. I think we would have a problem with that as we're looking at that form.
Right.
My question is, what is the right way to review this? We have lots of case law regarding voluntariness and whether or not a misstatement or miscommunications from an officer renders the renders the consent involuntary or coerced. We have a body of case law that addresses when there's a misstatement. We address that under our due process case law. What is the authority that says there's some third independent review apart from due process that we would look to determine compliance or misinformation under that subdivision? Why isn't this just a due process case?
It's not a due process case. I'm not arguing.
What's the right then that is being violated here if not a due process right?
Because under 169A.53 subdivision 3B6.
Right, quote, but 3, time subdivision of the request 3, just a minute, Mr. Christensen. Subdivision 3 is scope of review.
Right.
That's not the same thing as create. That says the district court can look at any of the following things. Really what we're looking at is subdivision 2, whether or not the officer did I think the statute says must, maybe it says shall. I thought it said must. But the person must be informed of the following, including refusal to submit to a breath test, right? I think that's the provision that is violated, not subdivision 3, because that relates to scope of review.
I understand.
So again, I'm going back to that subdivision 2. What is the right that's conferred here, and isn't it really a due process question for us? There's no separate independent right or obligation apart from what we've already looked at on the same kind of issue under due process analysis in different cases.
I'm just saying that the statute wasn't carried out. The statute expressly provides that drivers must be informed that, quote, refusal to submit to a breath test is a crime. And in this case, Mr. McCormick was not informed of that. He was told any test.
Right. Again, basically, we're getting to the facts. I'm still a step before that. I'm wanting to know, is there some authority that we look at compliance with subdivision 2 in the way you're seeking when there's a misinformation or a misstatement apart from the due process right that there is in this statute?
I doubt that. But is there a similar case that says that we have to interpret that you can't drive with a 0.08 or more blood alcohol content? No, because that's what the statute says. The statute is the authority. That is the authority. This is a creature of statute. It says, must be informed that refusal to submit to a breath test is a crime. That did not happen here. And that was a very important change. That's an incredibly important change. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. We need to promote respect for that. It's not fair to citizens that they have to follow the letter of the law, but when the government doesn't, well, we make excuses for them. If I was making excuses for my guilty clients who either were pled guilty or found guilty, I'd be laughed out of court. This is just excuses.
So this Minnesota Supreme Court has said that, has actually upheld deviations to the advisory as long as they're not misleading or confusing. So how would, now kind of looking at the facts, how is this misleading or confusing?
Well, the year before it said any test, and now it says breath test. So if you are aware that there are blood, breath, and urine tests, which I think most citizens are aware, whether they've been arrested or not, because it's a public law and we're presumed to know the law, that does mislead. We don't put adjectives in titles of documents. We put adjectives in the actual document. If I go and buy some canned peas and I get home and it says peas on the outside, but I get in there and it's tomatoes, it's not the same. That's the exact change they made, was to put breath in there, and now they don't read it and that's supposed to be okay? How does that promote respect for law enforcement? How does that fit that social policy? It doesn't. But if the guy gets a 0.08000, sorry, that's 0.08 or more. Well, sorry, that's the rule of law, sir.
So, counsel, your time for your opening remarks has expired. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Jacqueline Destash. I'm an assistant attorney general here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety. Your honors asked some good questions of opposing counsel, and I just wanted to address those before getting into my argument. Judge Reyes, you asked if Minnesota Statute 169A.5.1 requires that the statute be read verbatim. There's nothing in the statute that requires that. In addition, you asked if there was any case law that requires a statute to be read verbatim. There is no case law that requires that as well. Rather, the precedential case is the Halleck case, which specifically says while uniformity is, suggested, it's not required that the statute be read verbatim, and a deviation is not a violation necessarily.
Is the Halleck case a due process analysis?
No, Your Honor. And to address your question about what statutory right is being violated, I wanted to bring the court to the Tyler case, which explains that in order to be in compliance with the implied consent law and to revoke someone's driver's license, the implied consent law does need to be complied with. And so part of the implied consent law is Minnesota Statute 169A.5.1 Subdivision 2, which does require that the driver be informed of the rights and consequences of taking or refusing the test. So here today, we are here on a statutory violation issue. Whether or not Officer Jepson did adequately inform appellant of his rights and consequences as required by the implied consent law in order for the Commissioner of Public Safety to revoke his driver's license. The district court here correctly found that the petitioner's rights and consequences were adequately imparted to him. He was informed of all of those. The district court bases this on the facts that the petitioner was read a document and was told it was called the breath test advisory.
So, counsel, I want to go back to your original comments, and I have a few questions on those. And you, the first is you referenced the Halleck case where we said in 1985 that it's recommended that the officers read the exact test of the implied consent statute. Since that time, was 35 years ago, a lot has changed in terms of the implied consent laws, including a number of cases that have gone up to our Supreme Court, a number of cases that have gone up to the United States Supreme Court. And one in particular one, as appellant's counsel highlighted, is that there is a difference between a breath test and a blood test and a urine test. and the legislature specifically changed the language to make sure that in the new updated breath test advisory, that it says that refusal to submit to a breath test is a crime. And so it added the word breath to clarify we're not talking about urine, we're not talking about blood. Is HALAC, in light of that, really, that recommendation, is that really good law anymore? I mean, shouldn't we just say, you know what, that was a different day and age, and because of all of the cases that have clarified this issue, this really should be a requirement. Officers should read the advisory verbatim.
Your Honor, HALAC is the precedential case, and it is dispositive in this matter.
Well, it's not necessarily dispositive, because that's a case from our court. We can overrule ourselves, and that's part of my point why
yes.
It's a decision from this court, not from the Supreme Court.
Yes. HALAC has been reaffirmed by the Dierdahl versus Commissioner of Public Safety and the Patnode versus Commissioner of Public Safety cases that, while unpublished, offer guidance to this court on how to apply the facts of this specific case to HALAC, since the relevant facts of the Patnode case are identical to the facts here today. And the court in the Patnode case found there was no statutory violation because, when read in context, the statement refusal to take a test.
I'm going to interrupt again because I have the same question. Isn't Patnode a due process case?
There is also a statutory violation issue raised in Patnode as well, which this court did not find persuasive given in the context. HALAC requires that the statute does not need to be read verbatim as long as the statement is not an inaccurate statement of Minnesota law or so misleading as to render the advisory illegal. In the Patnode case, the discussion was that the statement refusal to take a test is a crime is not misleading or inaccurate when someone has read a document titled the breath test advisory, is asked or told refusal to take a test is a crime, is then only asked to submit to a breath test and offered no other test. It's not an inaccurate statement of law within that context, and it's not so misleading. And the district court here followed this guidance and relied on all of those same facts, and on A5 of the district court order cites that because of all these facts, it leaves no possibility of a metaphysical doubt in the appellant's mind as to what type of test he was being asked to take or the consequences of refusing that test. That is what is required under Minnesota Statute 169A.51, Subdivision 2, that the appellant is advised of the rights and the consequences.
I have another question. Okay, so looking at the Den case, that's a 1986 case, and that is a Supreme Court case. And there, the Supreme Court did say that a deviation is okay, not preferred, but is okay, as long as that advisory is not either misleading or confusing. And that's an or, that's in the disjunctive. So it could be, if it's either confusing or misleading, that would be a violation. And so why isn't it either misleading or confusing? And here's why. When you look at, even it, when you look at it in context, the advisory itself has been read to say that refusal to submit to a test is a crime. Those are the words for the advisory. So even if the person is offered a breath test, as in, I was in the Patnode case, but I think it was one of the other ones, the Dierdahl case. They were offered the test, the breath test. Why isn't that confusing? Because aren't you being told two different things? A test is a crime. Refusing to take a test, which is broad, ambiguous, and then just because you're offered a breath test, why isn't that confusing?
Your Honor, I believe it all really stems down to the context here, which, yes, when you do take the statement, refusal to take a test is a crime, alone without any context, it is uncertain. What are you referring to? However, when you are specifically being told, I'm reading you the breath test advisory, and will you take a breath test, is asked right after saying refusal to take a test is a crime. And there's no other test being offered in this case. The Ayers case and the Budo case, I think, really focus on that as well, saying they're not being asked, will you take a urine test, will you take a blood test? They're only being asked, will you take a breath test? So there is no confusion there when that's the only test being offered to you. And in that context, it's also not an inaccurate statement of Minnesota law. And the district court found this as well, that in this case, the petitioner did not offer, or the appellant did not offer, any evidence at the district court to show that he was confused or misled in any way either. The only evidence before the court is that he was read the breath test advisory, was asked if he would, told refusal to take a test as a crime, was asked if he would take a breath test, he said, sure, and was offered no other test. The district court correctly found that there is no room for doubt or confusion when taken in that context, and therefore he was properly advised of his rights and consequences, and there was no violation of the statute.
So if he had said, I'm confused, or I'm not sure what you mean by that, or does this mean I can only take a breath test, or can I take a different test? Do you think that would then have been a violation?
Your Honor, this is exactly why law enforcement officers are not required to read the statute verbatim. It is a fluid situation where different conversations can come up. People may ask those questions, and how the law enforcement officer responds is where the analysis then occurs into whether they're told misleading information or not. It's exactly why law enforcement, it would be an unnecessary burden to put on law enforcement officers to only be able to read the statute verbatim when you're put in a very fluid situation where lots of questions arise.
This just popped into my head. Are law officers, and I don't actually know the answer to this question, are officers required to read the Miranda statement verbatim?
I don't know the exact answer. However, that is a constitutional right. This is a statutory right, and the statutory right—
Unless there's a due process challenge.
Correct, Your Honor. And part of the due process challenge does require that the statement itself be so misleading that it's confusing, and that the driver also show that they were prejudiced by this misleading statement. So there is some overlap between the statutory challenge and the due process challenge. However, in this case, we just have the statutory challenge. So we're using the Halleck analysis, where was the statement inaccurate, and was it so confusing as to render the advisory illegal. The district court correctly found it was not confusing, and that the appellant was properly informed of his rights and consequences.
If there are two different statutory rights and due process rights at issue, what is the standard? Is it the same?
The due process analysis would go under the McDonnell.
Right, but what's the standard?
So misleading
as to be confusing? And is that the same standard under the statutory case? And
yes.
If so, then aren't the due process cases that have come out of this court, what weight do they have? Or what is their importance?
What's important about the due process case, I think, is the analysis of, so there's three elements in the McDonald claim. One, did the appellant actually take the test? Two, were they so misled by the statement that it was confusing or misleading? And three, did they prejudicially rely on this misleading statement? So the due process cases are important because prong two is essentially the same standard as what we're dealing with here with the statutory violation under Halleck. Was the statement so misleading, and was it so confusing to render the advisory illegal? So I think that in the due process cases, when they're analyzing that second prong, is where they're relevant here today. I guess if the court has no further questions for me, I have no further comments.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, thank you for the opportunity to respond, counsel for the commissioner. With regard to the Halleck case, what I noticed about that case was, number one, it's old. It's 30-something years old, 35 years old. And it concerned the right to counsel, not a refusal. It was a separate issue. And the law had just changed where there used to be a right to counsel, and this was this period of like 6 years until 91 when it was reestablished. And in this case, it's just a completely different I think it's completely misplaced in this analysis. Again, I just keep coming back to it is confusing when you put a sentence that says refusal to take a test is a crime. That is a misstatement of the law. And nowhere was Mr. McCormick read where the noun adjective breath in front of the test with in front of that saying it's a refusal to take a breath test is a crime. He was never told that in a sentence. He was never told that.
Why would we hold that under the statutory if there are two different, but not under due process? Or are you asking us to overrule the due process cases and publish something today?
No, we're not talking about due process. We're talking
right, but
about...
But the analysis addressed the same question, same facts. They said refusal to take a test, not a breath test. And we've held at least three different times, unpublished cases, that that's not a due process violation. So the question is, are you asking us now to publish something that says there's two different independent rights, one's due process, one's statutory. Under the statutory right, we're going to find that you do have to say the word breath. And are you asking us then to overrule those due process cases, or are you making some distinction that says under the statutory right it falls, but you're not really arguing with the previous unpublished cases regarding due process?
Yeah, I'm asking this court to make the police follow the law that was changed by the legislature. That was the one change they made, was putting the word breath in that sentence. I mean, then why change it? I mean, the Supreme Court changed it. Legislature took it up in 2017, sat down, rewrote the law. And the one change they made was breath, putting it right there in front of it. Because adjectives modify nouns. And like I put in there, what kind of test? Mr. McCormick was not informed that refusal to submit to a breath test is a crime. He was not informed that. That sentence never, ever was presented to him. And that's the one change the legislature made. How would you like to be the people in the legislature that sat on the subcommittee that rewrote this thing and now they know that it's not being carried out? And now we're making excuses for law enforcement? You know, we need to hold law enforcement to a higher standard here. We hold ourselves to high standards. We don't drive drunk. We follow the law. If it goes down to 06, we all have to comply.
So the Hallett case, I think, I mean, it did talk about the need to read the advisory. And in that case, it was actually the addition of a whole sentence that was at issue there. And the court did say that uniformity and given the implied consent advisory is highly encouraged. We recommend officers read the exact words to avoid any possibility of confusion or improper deviation from the statute. So, I mean, I think it does go to the issue of, you know, what we're actually talking about here.
Well, yeah, in this case, the Hallett case, the officer added his own language. Just added language off his head or something. I don't know where it came from. I don't know if it was written or if he just ad-libbed it there. But here, this change was by the legislature, signed by the governor of the state of Minnesota. We intend these laws to be carried out. If the citizens got to follow the letter of the law, then so does the law enforcement here.
Isn't the question how many times and in what places on this advisory does the word breath need to be there? It's in the title. It's in the final question. Do you wish to take will you take the breath test? And you're saying, well, that two isn't enough.
No.
Every time it says test, it has to say breath.
Yes. When you're talking about whether or not refusal to take a test is a crime, yeah, you got to put the word breath in there. Let's be specific. Because that's what happened at the United States Supreme Court, is they made a distinction between blood and urine and breath as to how big of the intrusion it is. I disagreed with it. I think that, you know, I think there should be warrants for breath tests too. I think it's just as much of an intrusion, but that's how they came down on it, and it made the law more complicated, and the legislature complied with the Supreme Court and changed the statute to make that change. And then in this case, it doesn't happen. My time is up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel for presenting this case today. It is now submitted to the court for our decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So with that, we've completed the three oral matters on our calendar today, and we will be in recess for our non-oral matters. Thank you.
All right. Thank you again.